Kathy Kelly is the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, which was founded in 1996 to oppose the effects of economic sanctions on Iraqi civilians. Kathy has been to Iraq many times, including during the entire invasion by the United States in March of 2003. Kathy is a three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee for her work in Iraq.
So Kathy, I know that you're in touch with a lot of people in Iraq by various means still, or at least I think that you are. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us about some of their stories. What is life like for ordinary Iraqis on the ground today?
Well, the other day I was standing at an intersection, a busy intersection in Chicago. It was before sunrise and we wanted to catch the traffic as they'd be going around the bend onto Lakeshore Drive. And I was holding up a vinyl picture with a beautiful photo of a young woman, Johan, who at age 14 weighed 76 pounds. And shortly after the Shock and Awe campaign, my friend Kathy Breen was at her bedside regularly. And she went to visit the little girl for a fourth time, and Johan had died. And Johan had cancer both before, for the long years of economic sanctions, before the Shock and Awe campaign, and after. It's been very, very difficult for doctors to deliver health care to children, to civilians, to people that are felled by the war. And I was particularly thinking of Johan's brother, Leith, because he writes to me these very charming letters. Hi, how are you? I hope you are okay. I still miss my sister, Johan. I think of her a lot. And how do you respond, knowing that with the kinds of policies the United States is following, Leith isn't much more secure, even though he may never go into a hospital, as the roadside explosives and the car bombings and the attacks on mosques and police stations continue. So I think of Leith and the tremendous insecurity amidst which he's growing up, and yet he's willing to keep on finding an internet cafe and sending out messages, beleaguered but friendly messages, to people like me in another land far away, where I never, ever experience anything even vaguely close to the everyday life of people like Leith. And there's so many families that are in a similar situation. We also had a message on our message machine from a friend, Haider, who had come and lived with us for 6 months. And Tom, I know that you probably have spent more time than most in Haider's living room, because when we were in Basra in the summer of 2000, that was the place to go to kind of let your hair down. That
That's
was where
right.
We all felt that we could relax a little bit. It was clear that Haider was doing her very level best not to get tied into the Ba'ath party. And we were lucky. We could just go in without a minder, without accompaniment. And Haider, having been here, taught me so much, because, you know, every time we went into that home, as I recall, everything stopped. People scurried about making sure that we each had a cup of tea, if they could come up with enough money to go and get Pepsis. We'd each have Pepsis. If you tried to, you know, move your Pepsi over to the little kid gazing up at you, they wouldn't dare take it. And we were just the guests, treated as guests of honor, even though we just lived down the street and we'd been there for months. But when Haider came here to visit, it was wonderful. We celebrated it. And we really did do our best to make sure that she got health care, that Mustafa got health care, that Mustafa was enrolled temporarily in a school. This family that had been attacked by a bomb that directly hit their home, which was intended for a fertilizer plant, and somehow went egregiously and horribly astray and hit their home. But we would be very intent on staring at our computer screens and answering the phones and putting out our mailings. And in some ways, I wonder, what would it be like for us to slow down, to kind of exhale, relax, focus on guests, have the leisure time to think about what we're doing and where we're going. And so on my mind very, very much during the month of Ramadan was the stark contrast between our Muslim brothers and sisters who have fashioned a way of life wherein for one whole solid month, five times a day, they're on their knees, their foreheads touch the floor, the children watch as the adults pray for peace, visibly, actively, five times a day, where every night the whole family at sunset gathers together and relaxes and shares a meal and has camaraderie. The kids play with one another. They know their cousins well. And then they collect the money that they didn't spend on food, no, even the poorest of families, for a solid month. And they make sure that gets sent to the people who don't even have as much as they do. I mean, there's so much to learn, I think, particularly during the Christmas season, when now people are revving up for an orgy of shopping and consumption, and then, you know, people don't even know that one of their major consumptions throughout the year is weapons, because at least a third to a half of our productivity gets laid right at the doorstep of the Defense Department with its obscene $524 billion budget for next year. So, Tom, you'll remember from your time in Chicago a little girl who lived across the street, Heather, and we all said, Heather comes in, she did get treated like the guest of honor.
Yeah.
She could use our computers. We probably got about four viruses out of that. But well, Heather's a teenager now, and I asked her, Heather, what are you and your friends saying about the war on terror? What do people say in your school? And she looked at me in kind of an all innocence, and she said, oh, well, everybody knows it's those Arabs up on Devon Avenue that are the terrorists. And I felt this sinking sense of loss. You know, how have we lost the opportunity to help other people in our own neighborhoods, my neighbors across the street, to better understand who our Muslim brothers and sisters are? And how do we celebrate the birth of the Prince of Peace in our country when there's such a tremendous divide, not, you know, the clash of civilizations, but between basic curiosity and a kind of numbing lack of awareness?
Well, that sort of brings me to my next question, too. What is Voices in the Wilderness telling people or suggesting to people that we can do here in the United States, things that, you know, can hopefully help the situation in general?
You know, if you'd asked me this question a year ago, Tom, I would have hesitated about saying that the United States must get out of Iraq as soon as possible. I was still thinking, well, there's got to be some kind of protective presence, and it would take time, and thinking about financial institutions and reconstruction projects. But at this point, I think it's incumbent on people all throughout the United States who would like to see an end to warfare to say that the United States has got to issue an immediate timetable for withdrawal of all troops, shutting down those four major military bases and each of what I think are 13 smaller ones. You know, 2 years ago, nobody was saying, gee, I'd feel a lot more secure if we had four major bases in Iraq. Let those bases go. I think the United States has to acknowledge to the world community we made a terrible mistake and ask countries that were not part of the coalition that attacked Iraq and began the occupation and continues it, ask those countries under the auspices of the United Nations or the European community to try to fashion some kind of a protective presence, yes, but the United States has got to get out of Iraq, bring the U.S. troops home, stop putting those young people's lives on the line, forcing them to go into situations where they can be ambushed and killed, and stop creating a situation where I believe we're, as a professor out on the West Coast said, we're creating terrorists faster than we can kill them. Now, how do we say that? How do we put that message forth? It's not easy. I think it requires daily activity, planning the large actions, grassroots, local actions, going to visit the Congress people, staying abreast of the news and the updates. And I know I'm laying out a menu that's exhausting. But, you know, when I think of people who stand at the middle of the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., and I know many of them think, gee, if we got engaged sooner, might one half of those names not be listed on that war memorial. When I think of the 2 million Vietnamese who died in the course of that tragic and devastating and abysmally useless war, I wonder, is it possible to avoid a moral imperative to stop this war? Now, the other thing that comes to my mind very painfully but unavoidably is that the Bush administration, claiming a mandate to continue its policies, really doesn't want anything from most of us who aren't of military recruitment age other than our consent and our money. They don't even care about our consent. Basically, they want our money. And that's the one thing we do have control over. So I'm saying to people now, if there's any way that you can find a means to engage in non-payment of federal income tax, in war tax refusal, I think that's a moral imperative right now. We're not talking about Germany in 1939. If somebody refuses to cooperate, to give the Bush administration the one thing it wants from us, you're not going to find yourself in a concentration camp. You're not going to be beheaded. It'll mean a change in lifestyle, but I think that's good for us. You know, we need to learn how to cut back on our consumption, to live more simply, to live with less, to share our resources, to find ways to advocate nonviolence. I think that's terribly important. I think in local neighborhoods, many people can probably walk to the nearest recruitment station, can probably just take a six-block walk and be at a high school that's at risk of being turned into not just a military recruitment place, but possibly a military school. Go to those places and help to connect with the parents there, with the students there, and develop campaigns to say, we don't want our youth to be recruited into the military. We don't want them to be lured into believing that policies based on intimidation and threat and using our young people to kill and be killed are the only way forward. I think it's also important to look at the health care issues here. I'm so impressed by a group of health care professionals in Chicago who are, beginning December 10th on Human Rights Day, going to start a vigil at as many hospitals as they can generate awareness in, wherein the healthcare professionals with their white coats and their stethoscopes will be standing outside, doctors and nurses and x-ray technicians, and saying, we have a public healthcare crisis here. We can't deliver adequate healthcare, and it's not because the resources aren't available. It's because those resources are being directed toward attacks that have shattered the healthcare system and delivery within Iraq, within Afghanistan, attacks that have created burgeoning, spiraling crises. It's hard to list them all within the population of Iraq and within the soldiers who are being sent over there now, 12,000 or more. And we'll come back here, many of them maimed, disfigured, psychologically distraught. So we need to be finding ways to tell the truth visibly and in a compelling way here in our own cities. It's a good idea to be in touch with a group like the Italian non-governmental organization, Emergency. Gino Strada, who is the director of that group, has developed clinics in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Sierra Leone and in the Sudan, and particularly in the north of Iraq, they've got clinics for people who've survived landmine explosions. And they claim that if a healthcare professional goes over there and works for them for 3 to 6 months, they'll never be able to support war again after they've seen the bodies torn apart by these horrible bombs, and will come back to their countries and alert people to where the weapons are being created and where the weapons are part of a profit structure here. So I think, you know, it's good to make sure that Gino Strada gets a full hearing when he comes to the United States in March of 2005. Voices would be glad to help people coordinate speaking engagements for him. He'll be speaking here in Chicago. We've got him first, March 1st to 4th. But to give a good hearing to those kinds of people whose voices need to be heard, not just the generals who stand up to the podium in Qatar and other places and talk about the casualty rates as though this is to be acceptable because, after all, we're at war.
Right now, there's particularly within, you know, if you want to call it the broader activist community, there's a sort of sense of disappointment with the results of the election and so on. And I'm hearing a question that I would love to hear a response from you about this. And the question is, how do you keep going when you're dealing against, you know, the military, industrial, media, congressional, add your own, you know, other words to that complex? How do you keep on going in the face of these disappointments?
You know, I think it makes certainly crucial sense for all of us to sit back and evaluate and ask ourselves, where are we at right now? The activist community in the United States has made incredible accomplishments and gains, and I think those need to be evaluated and not forgotten. The New York Times referred to the world's only other superpower, public opinion, in the lead-up to the war. I think over 7,800 people had been arrested protesting that war. People filled the streets. They filled Lakeshore Drive here in Chicago and shut it down. Internationally, I think public opinion came closer than ever before to stopping a war before it started. So I don't think we should lose sight of that. We were out-manipulated. We were out-orchestrated. We were outspent. Those are all realities we have to deal with. And I think, again, I want to refer to that moral imperative, that if you are yearning for peace, don't pay for war. But I think one of the things that we've not been as adept at is in linking together our grassroots communities. In other words, connecting the dots as best we can. I mean, I feel very good this morning because a young woman is using our fax machine as I speak to put out information about an event tonight that commemorates the horrible industrial accident in Bhopal, India, when Union Carbide's plant blew up. And they've sold that plant now to the Dow Chemical Company, and these youngsters are saying, look, Dow Chemical Company still has a responsibility in that regard to the people in India, in Bhopal, and around the world. And that was one of the instances when a terrible weapon of mass destruction affected civilian lives in a horrible way. But we have to always connect, make our resources available, go to other people's events. And I know, you know, it may sound as though I'm laying out an agenda that makes it impossible for people, but I'm convinced that on an everyday basis within our own communities, we can still do a great deal more to link together. Voices in the Wilderness has on its website a statement called Counter-Terror, Build Justice. Counter-Terror, Build Justice. While the Bush administration is pounding us with how supportive we must be to them, otherwise we're practically treasonous in their war against terror, I think if we sit back and ask ourselves who really is countering the potential for terrorist acts in our world, it's the people who are working on the sweatshop issue, working on the anti-globalization issue, working on the free trade agreements issue, trying to establish just and fair relationships between people who actually do much more to counter terrorism because they recognize the grievances other people have and they're trying to do something about it. So I think to be assertive and to join together on joint statements, and then in this instance with regard to the Counter-Terror Bill Justice, commit, pledge to one action in the spring of 2005 during a month when the UK, the US, and the Canadian militaries will be doing joint exercises for what they feel that they're going to do to counter terror, preparing for a terrorist attack. We should be preemptive. We should do what we can to prevent such a thing, but then to say to our neighbors, to the people who are beyond the choir, look, you know, we are all about the business of trying to make a safer and a more secure world, and try to find that soccer mom who might be vulnerable to being frightened for her children and say, look, if you want to make a world that's safer for your kids, don't saddle those kids with the debt for this reckless policy that the Bush administration pursues. If you want a safer world for your kids, listen to what people are saying who want to attack. If your next-door neighbor had a garage full of guns and said he was going to attack your home because your dog barks too much at night, you might think about, you know, a way to resolve that situation because you don't want that person to attack you. It makes sense to listen to what other people in other parts of the world are saying. The other thing I would say when people are feeling as though, well, this is hopeless, is to just look at a pie chart of the world's population. We're 6% of the world's population. 94% of the world, I believe, has many, many, many communities within their populations who are saying, go, please, keep up. We're right behind you. This is exactly what we want to hear. And so we have to use the Internet wisely to be in touch with other people in other parts of the world who do want the activist communities in the United States to continue their work, who feel dependent on us, who are very aware that we've got, you know, roomfuls of faxes and computers and copy machines at our fingertips, many of us, accesses to communication that they don't have, and we can get 3 square meals, our refrigerators are stocked, and they're just dying, literally dying, for us to keep on going. You and I, Tom, knew every time we walked away from the bedside of an imploring mother and a dying child that our lives were changed, that we couldn't walk away and say, sorry, it's really an uphill battle back in the United States. People just don't want to hear about it. You made a movie. You poured yourself into that. You lost a lot of money on it. but you had to do it, and here you are this morning at a radio station. You could have gone a completely different route and been a successful trial lawyer with a great education and degree behind you, but you made real big changes in your life. I watched that happen. And I think that I can't name an activist in the United States who's dedicated himself or herself in the last years to trying to resist and stop the reckless pursuit that the current administration is pursuing, or that the Clinton administration pursued with regard to 500,000 children in Iraq who died, who says, oh gosh, I wish I hadn't gotten involved in this. I mean, we might laugh at sometimes and say, gee, ruin for life. But if I ask anybody that was involved in Voices in the Wilderness, do you wish you'd never gone there? I might know that people saturate their pillows at night weeping for the lack of effectiveness that we had. We didn't end the sanctions. We didn't stop a war. But I don't know anybody who says, gee, I wish I'd started getting involved in the stock market instead.
I do actually have one more question, and it has to do with the, to a certain extent, with the language that's used by the Bush administration in talking about not only the attacks of 9/11, but they even use the term terrorists in reference to people in Iraq who are fighting the so-called coalition troops. You know, first it was, they were Saddam holdouts, then they became insurgents and foreign terrorists and things like that. What's your perspective on that, and, you know, who are they, and also what exactly do the people referred to as terrorists want from us?
We've wanted to listen very, very carefully to our friend Michael Birmingham, who had a very unusual experience of remaining in Iraq, both from October onward before the Shock and Awe campaign, during much of the bombing, then came in right after the bombing and stayed until about May of 2004. And Michael cautions us. He says, be very, very careful. Keep asking questions. Don't make assertions when you may not know what you're talking about. So I want to preface an answer to your question with that. It's difficult to know who is organizing the many various campaigns of violence going on in Iraq today and what their agendas are and what they hope to accomplish. I think you can say across the board that with 46% of Iraq's people being children, with each of those children having parents who want to be able to get a job and earn a living and send their kids to school and have a clinic where they could get medicines, and for the poorest of the poor, not have to cope with sewage seeping into their homes, not have to cope with a lack of electricity, with poisoned water. People want to live. They don't want to live under occupation if occupation, as it has played out, means that the job potential is first farmed out to U.S. people who can make $80,000 to $120,000 a year tax-free for doing security jobs, often being protected by guys in their shirt sleeves who are making maybe $8 a month. That kind of incredible unfairness just isn't going to go very far to win over hearts and minds in Iraq. People naturally aren't going to want to continue to have traffic jams that are 4 hours long in Baghdad just trying to get out of their neighborhood so that they might be able perhaps to visit a relative when they can't call because the phone lines aren't working. No, people don't like to step out of their beds in the morning in the winter months and they can't get electricity to fuel a space heater, and they discover that now cooking oil that used to cost 1,500 Iraqi dinar for a can now costs 10,000 Iraqi dinar for a can, and they can't afford it. How are they going to cook? They don't want to know that the roads are so impossible now that convoys can't bring food in, And if they don't have cooking oil, even if the lentils do get distributed, how do you heat them up and cook them? These are very basic needs that people in Iraq want to see met. Now, I would imagine many are still holding out for some hope based on the simple observation that you can't drink the oil. Iraqis don't want to drink their oil. They want to sell it. They've got an incredibly valuable resource. How frustrating it must be for people to know that potentially they have extraordinary wealth, and yet they're living in miserable poverty. So I think that we could certainly conjecture that most people in Iraq want a fair share. They want to be dealt with as human beings. Now, with that said, the complications are myriad. There are people in the north who may feel that their best bet, as Kurds who hoped that they could move back into homes that they once owned before Saddam engaged in an ethnic cleansing and forced them out of their homes and Arabized their areas, they may think their best bet is to see the United States triumph over any kind of armed insurgency, and that they would be the ones who would get control over the northern oil field and get their homes back and be able to set up a situation where, after having horrible insecurity for many years, they might be able to settle in. It may be that some of the Shia people in the south are hoping that the United States would ultimately respect them and be rid of people who had very little care and concern for their needs during Saddam Hussein's regime. It may be that there are people who feel that any kind of collaboration with the occupation is going to signal future disaster and an ongoing subjugation of peoples, and they're never going to lay down their arms, and they're going to educate their children to keep on fighting. It seems to me the thing that would make a great deal of sense is to stop pouring weapons into the region, to monitor the borders, yes, to make sure that no more weapons go in, no more companies profit from selling weapons, to stop putting U.S. monies into so-called security when the simple securities of being able to have a job that benefits from reconstruction might be the far better way to spend the money. And yes, it's true, the European communities, humanitarian organizations have said, sorry, we're not going to be able to devote any money until it becomes more secure. But I think the handwriting on the wall is clear. The United States is not going to be able to secure that country as long as the U.S. is in charge of a hated occupation. And so when could we count on violence to subside? I think the United States needs to take the risk of issuing an apology, suppose that will never happen, at least issue a timetable for withdrawal of troops, for shutting down the bases, and for putting the supervision of reconstruction into the hands of groups that do not include anyone who is part of the coalition that began this hated and ridiculous and reckless war. Tom, I guess I'd also like to say that if people amongst your listeners feel that they're not going to get anywhere with their elected leadership, don't forget about the religious leaders in the communities. The Bush administration has done a great deal to co-opt the religious communities in no small measure by giving vast sums of money that should have gone through the United States health, education, and welfare programs. Money that was withdrawn from those programs has gone increasingly into the churches, and that's where many people go when they need to get a handout. It's not fair that they have to do that in the first place, but when they go to those churches, they're told, who takes care of you, Papa Bush? So I think we've got to start going to the churches and saying, how much longer are we going to have the very base groups for preaching love of enemy, love of neighbor, and care for other people being co-opted by people who have no problem writing off the lives of hundreds of thousands of children in other lands and aren't doing much to serve the children here? You know, how they calculate the number of prison beds to have in the future, they examine the IQ tests amongst the early grade school children in poor neighborhoods.
Kathy Kelly, thank you so much for being with us on Making Waves today.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson.